Hi, everyone. I'm Lisa.
And I'm Nick.
And you're listening to It Takes Two, the podcast where two people take two movies with the same plot or premise and watch and discuss them.
And in this episode, we're covering off 2016 stop-motion feature Kubo and the Two Strings and Pixar's animated feature Coco.
Yeah. People who know Coco and don't know Kubo might be surprised that we're not comparing Coco with The Book of Life, which is a film that is also about the Day of the Dead, and they were kind of considered to be twin films because they were in production at the same time. But in fact, The Book of Life came out, I believe, 6 years before Coco did, because Coco took so long to make.
Makes sense.
And also, honestly, I think the premises of these two movies are closer together than just saying these are two animated movies about the Day of the Dead.
Well, because one of them takes...
No, I'm saying, as in, like, that's the only link between Book of Life and Coco.
Right.
Yeah, so this is fun. So Kubo and the Two Strings, for anyone who doesn't know it, it's by Laika, who are the same studio who did Coraline and Paranorman and the Box Trolls. It is set in feudal Japan, and it has basically the same plot as Coco. There's a lot of similarities in these. It's funny because I came up with the idea of comparing these, and I talked to my younger sibling who has seen both movies and was like, do you think these are close enough to compare? And they were like, oh, for this reason? And I was like, oh, I didn't even think of that. I was thinking of this reason and this reason and this reason. And then I went, I've talked myself into this. these are very similar. What did you think? Because you had seen Coco but not Kubo before, yeah. Right?
Both movies are about memory, they're about music, they're about family, they're about legacy, they're about the youngest member of a family discovering the truth of the family, which has been hidden in a way, sort of in more of a emotional defense, and that's where the memory comes into play. The music, especially for both of these movies, holds a strong point. You have a boy who can make origami using his basically inherited magic, and he's very much like, the whole thing to me is very much a D&D story for Kubo.
I always feel like Kubo would be an absolutely amazing video game.
Yeah. Because you're about a boy whose village is destroyed, and then you like start recruiting other heroes to help you on your journey to get stronger, to defeat the villain.
To pick up like special items.
Yeah. It's very RPG-esque.
Yeah.
The fact that it's in Japan also helps as well, because it does feel like a very cut and paste like adventure story. Coco is beautiful in a completely different way. Like, yeah. I love stop motion animation. It's very expensive.
Yep.
It's very time consuming. And not everybody gets it. I did find something horribly creepy, and I don't remember what it was.
Was it the ants? The two aunties with their
No,
masks?
Not in this movie, just in general in stop motion. I don't remember. There was a property that I felt really uncomfortable watching.
It wasn't Jan Svankmajer's Alice, was it? Where he used actual taxidermied rabbit as the white rabbit in Alice in Wonderland?
No, but that's... Because
that is, will stick in my memory forever.
You should watch Watership Down in Te Reo Māori. It is way worse.
There is something very creepy about using actual taxidermied animals in stop-motion animation, though. Yeah. That creeped me out.
Fun fact for those audience playing the home bingo game that has not been released and never will be for It Takes Two podcast. I confessed to Lisa before we were dating about my obsession with recreating a Civil War, like an American Civil War battle scene using taxidermied animals, and I thought it was very funny. Because you'd just be like, here, here's my like entire room that's dedicated to the Battle of, you know, Gettysburg, but, you know, I think it was actually Revolutionary War. I forget. Too many wars, and then I'm not American. Anyway, back to the movies at hand. Coco is gorgeous.
Yeah.
And I feel like Pixar have been really good for a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like when criticism comes towards a Pixar movie, it is usually held at a different standard, which I don't think is fair.
Mm.
And I feel like celebrities, especially women, also receive the same sort of criticism.
Right.
When you're held to such a high standard that you constantly exceed, or you make an standard that you then meet constantly. It's like sales, right? If you constantly are the highest salesperson, then you have a bad month. Then none of the rest of the 80%, 90% of the time actually matters. It's only the time you flopped.
Yep.
And I feel like that's Pixar's held at a higher standard than a lot of other animation studios. Mm. Because, like, you go back to, you look at Toy Story 1, and then you look at Toy Story 3, and they are so much more crisp now. And it's almost like a gateway to, they lure you in with fun, bright animations and then tell you the most heart-wrecking stories.
Yeah.
And it is such a diabolical way of doing film structure.
Yeah, I will say I didn't get through either of these movies without crying.
I noticed.
Also, I was thinking about it while we were watching them, that we, in a recent episode on, I was trying to remember what it was, but it was on the Haunted Mansion movies, said that the 2023 Haunted Mansion movie, is that right? Is that the right year? I don't know. Whatever the most recent Haunted Mansion movie was, is a really good movie for teaching children about grief and how to handle grief.
Yeah.
Both of these movies are like gold standard for that.
Yeah, yeah.
These are about young boys who have lost their you know, a familial figure and are going through, you know, understanding death and understanding what happens to us after we die or in different cultures.
Yeah.
And also, like, they both have this really strong theme of being kept alive in memory through the storytelling of the generations after us.
Yeah.
There's literally a quote in Kubo, because that's the whole plot of Coco.
Yeah.
But I took down a quote from Kubo, oh, maybe I didn't take down the one that I thought about it. But the one I just took down was, memories are powerful things. But there was another quote that I thought I took down, but don't seem to have taken down, where someone says to someone else, when you die, that's not your real death. You will live on through him and through the stories he tells to other people. And I thought, that is literally the entire plot of Coco.
Yeah, yeah.
In this one, like, line in Kubo and the Two Strings.
It's fascinating because there's a philosophical, thank you, Lisa. Philosophical word that states, a saying that states, you die twice.
Yep.
The first when you leave this mortal plane, and the second time is the last time everyone remembers your name.
And that's what happens in Coco.
Correct. That's, like, the whole thing about Coco. Yeah, it's definitely the archetype of a young man trying to find, you know, his legacy because of the legacy of his father, because of the legacy of his family. Such a fascinating way they've done it in both these situations. They have, like, an actual physical threat, and then they have this sort of philosophical threat of, you know, only those who have photos put up by their families, I cannot remember the word.
The ofrender.
Ofrender can pass over into the living world during, it's not Dia de los Muertos, what is it?
Yeah, Dia de los Muertos.
Yeah. And, you know, this whole thing of going into the underworld and meeting, you know, these people to help him on his way.
And also that, like, he's able to recognize all of his deceased relatives, even though they're now, you know, in this Calavera doll style, where there are these skeletons with beautiful markings and, you know, paint on them. He recognizes them from the photos on the ofrenda that they put up every year. So he knows who they all are based on that, which is a cool kind of addition to it, because it's like, not only is like the importance of the Ofrenda to them coming through to actually get to, you know, see their family, but it's also that that is how their story is being passed on, because the whole kind of big thing around Coco is that his great-great-grandfather, so Miguel is the main character, his great-great-grandfather isn't on the Ofrenda because he left the family, and so they don't pass on his story, and so he's not on the Ofrenda, he doesn't get to cross over, he doesn't, you know, Miguel doesn't even know who he is, essentially, and he is going in search of him.
It's a very, without getting into too many spoilers, it's also shaped his, like, generations of his family.
Yeah.
Because he was a mariachi, a guitar player and singer, they, and because he abandoned his family, that's why he's not there. And it's also why the family is so adverse to music.
Yeah.
And Miguel wants to live the lifestyle of, you know, what's in his DNA, it's in his blood, that so many other people have focused on being cobblers and shoemakers this entire time, that everybody, like, it's just the thing that they do in the family.
Yeah.
And he's just like, no, I want to rebel against what you're putting for me, because there is actually another side of our family that no one talks about.
Yeah.
And it's very beautiful because, you know, the person who the last person to remember her own father is Coco, and that's why there's such a, like, that sort of need to fulfill all these things, all these little tasks that he needs to do, and the way it's done is just such a beautiful storytelling.
Mm.
And they are definitely movies that are definitely worth watching together, looking at them as both movies that are about the same thing.
Yeah. I really, really love Kubo and the Two Strings. I think I do love that the kind of opening to Kubo and the Two Strings is him telling the story of basically how he got to where he is, but and it sounds like it's a child being very dramatic, and then you later find out, like, oh no, this is real.
Yeah.
But I love the kind of in-joke of, you know, don't blink, you know, don't look away. If you look away now, our hero will surely die. And it's like, yeah, that's because every, like, microsecond of this film took so much effort, because it's a stop-motion animation. So they don't want you to look away. They want you to, like, stay focused on this movie. It is so beautiful just to look at. And I think Coco is as well. And the storytelling is fantastic. And there's, you know, there's things that get revealed. I don't know how much we want to do spoilers, because I know you don't like giving spoilers when you really, really like the movies.
That's the thing. Like, it's fine to sort of... This is the problem with kids' movies, right? Because every year there is generations of children and parents that may have missed this because, you know, they weren't parents at the time when these movies came out.
Yeah.
To tell you now what happens in these movies, like, down to a detail, I don't feel does the movie justice.
Yeah.
Because they are great stories, and they kind of need to be shown rather than heard.
Yeah.
Show, don't tell. Terrible way of people are doing tell, not show anymore in TV. And I blame doom scrolling for that. But anyway, no, it's just, it's hard to walk the line in this situation, because telling you anything is...
Yeah.
It doesn't have the same impact, you know, listening
and through there's also whatever platform, like,
you're listening on.
Thinking of, like, something very specific, there are spoilers in these movies that are almost the same in both movies, which I think is... I'm like, this is such a big connection between these movies that this one thing happens... But I understand not wanting to mention it.
It's almost like you take the same script and you write it in two different places.
You put it in Mexico or in feudal Japan.
Yeah.
I think I really appreciate how both movies deal with the cultures that they're set in as well, and with the, like, cultural storytelling and music and art. Because in Kubo and the Two Strings, he plays a shamisen, which is a traditional Japanese instrument. I've probably pronounced that wrong, so I'm apologize to. I know we've got at least one listener who's fluent in Japanese. But he uses origami and the shamisen for storytelling.
Magic
and,
also.
Yeah, and magic, which he's inherited
from
one side of his family, which is connected to the music as well. He's inherited the music and the magic. And in Coco, you have, obviously there's like the ofrendas, there's the kind of, I believe they're called Calavera doll style, skeletons.
Yeah.
They do a little bit of storytelling at the beginning with these traditional like paper bunting or flags called papel picado. So I liked that both movies, even though it's used much less in Coco, both movies actually did like a traditional form of paper art to do storytelling. And then obviously he, you know, plays guitar, there's mariachi bands and music in it. And they have the like spirit guide animal things, which I did take down what they're called, and I'm struggling to find it. Alebrijes. So those are traditionally, they're like little figurines made out of paper mache or carved out of wood that represent mythical animal hybrids. Which I think is also interesting because in Kubo, and this isn't a spoiler, really, in Kubo he has a little charm, which is a carving of a monkey, that then comes to life when he goes on his adventure. And in Coco, you know, these alebrijes, which come to life in the Land of the Dead, in the real world, in actual fact, are little wooden carvings.
Yeah.
So I think that's a cool connection. Though he has one, you know, a guide who is a Sholo dog, which are supposed to be kind of spirit guides as well. And that dog actually brings him into the Land of the Dead and helps guide him while he's in there, even though he thinks he's not guiding him because he doesn't have the full picture.
Oh, sorry, I was just going over the cast. The cast of Kubo is insane.
Oh, yeah. The only problem I would have with the cast of Kubo is that very few of them are Japanese. Whereas the cast of Coco are almost exclusively Mexican.
Yeah, it's true.
Which I thought was interesting, but it is like, you know, it's not that none of them are Japanese.
Yeah.
And also, it's a different studio, maybe doesn't have the same pull, and also, you know, probably when you're based in California, easier to get voice actors from Mexico than it is when you're based in, I believe they're in Seattle, Washington, I think, Laika, and you're trying to get voice actors from Japan.
Yeah.
Might not be quite as simple a task, especially on a lower budget. Though they definitely had a budget because the actors that they have in there are big name actors.
Yeah.
But I do know they were also inspired by Hayao Miyazaki's films and I think Akira Kurosawa's films. And obviously Hayao Miyazaki and Studio Ghibli in general have, in their English dubs, have like quite popular English speaking actors that are not Japanese in those. But then again, a lot of them aren't necessarily... Well, no, actually, most of them are set in Japan. I was going to say a lot of them aren't set in Japan, but I was just thinking of, like, Howl's Moving Castle is...
Definitely not in Japan.
Yeah. But actually, now that I think about it, quite a lot of them are set in Japan. Porco Rosso is in Italy, right? For a lot of it.
There is no definition of where Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind is set, because it's post-apocalyptic.
Princess Mononoke, though, is
definitely Japan. Yeah.
Like the Wind Rises and stuff like that. Like there's a lot of them are set in Japan. Anyway.
Tales of Earthsea.
But they don't have Tales of Earthsea. Earthsea is not in Japan. But either way, like I can understand that maybe they're looking at those movies and saying, well actually even Miyazaki doesn't cast like fully Japanese actors in his English speaking versions of the films. So I get it, you know.
It does really help with marketing it to parents as well, and I understand why they do that, because your kid's not going to know who well, shouldn't know who Christian Bale is, but if he's playing Hal and you're the audience being like, oh yeah, I know this, you know, oh, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And saying like, oh yeah, I want to see Charlize Theron and Matthew McConaughey in this, you know, stop motion animation film about feudal Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they're both really, really cool movies. They do both obviously deal with themes of death. I think it's interesting because, like, people think of Coco and think about it being a very sad movie, and they're not wrong. But I think Kubo is a lot more sad. For reasons that are spoilers, I guess.
Yeah.
But even paring it down to stuff that's not spoilers, that he's, you know, Kubo is living on his own with his mother. He hasn't known his father in his lifetime. He's only known the stories that his mother has passed on to him. you know, and he lives, and they're living in fear because his mother tells him these stories and tells him, actually, your grandfather is a mythical moon king and he wants to steal your eyes. And Kubo only has one eye, and it's like, he's very much, you know, he's trying to go out and enjoy, you know, his life in the village and using his music, you know, and his passion and for storytelling to, like, you know, like, have a good time in the village, but then he's looking after his mother.
It's not even having a good time in the village. They literally live in a cave.
Yeah.
And he has to return back to the cave before sunset.
Yeah.
Which I won't explain why, because it's a spoiler.
I've just said that it's...
Yeah, okay. And he's literally begging. Like, this is... He's basically busking.
Yeah.
Because his mother is broken.
Yeah, and he's looking after her.
Yeah.
And she has moments of memory where she can tell the story. And that is also comes through in Coco,
yeah.
That there's moments, you know, that, so the name Coco comes from, Miguel's great grandmother, who's Mama Coco, and she is towards end of life, and her memory comes back in little bits and pieces, but mostly isn't there, and that's the same with Kubo's mother and Kubo and the Two Strings. Yeah, so Kubo is looking after his mother, living just the two of them, you know. It is, his situation overall is more desolate than Coco, who is in a loving family, even if they don't quite understand him. He has this big family, they're all looking after each other, and it's just that he has this clash with them because he wants to be a musician, and they've banned music. And I will say, also, another, like, big comparison between the two is actually how they get into their adventuring stuff. Because in both cases, they end up going on this whole adventure because, A, they're going against their family's wishes, in Coco because he wants to play music, and in Kubo because he stays out after dark.
Yeah.
And B, they're doing it at a local village celebration for lost loved ones.
Yeah.
So in Coco, it's Dia de los Muertos. And he's going to play at this, you know, he wants to play at this competition in his local town, where there's all the, like, mariachi guitar players. And in Kubo and the Two Strings, it's that, the you know, someone else that he busks with in the village tells him about this lantern thing that they're doing, where, like, everyone is building their own lanterns and putting them on, basically, on gravestones of their lost loved ones and talking to them. And if the light lights up, it means that they've been heard, and then they put them out in the river. And he uses his origami skills to create a lantern to speak to his father, and then gets frustrated when it doesn't light up.
Yeah.
And then ends up staying out after dark, and, you know, things ensue.
Adventure ensues,
and suddenly, like, you know, in both cases, the boys end up kind of magically going to another place, and then they're on a quest where they have to, like, they're accompanied by someone else that they've just met, that they have to go to, like, they're accompanied by, like, the equivalent of their spirit animal, and a person they've just met who wants to help them, but is, you know, slightly more reluctant or more... looking for his own selfish needs in Coco than in Kubo, but and then they go off on their quest to find, you know, a list of things, basically.
Yeah. Gonna need that list.
Yeah. Well, in Kubo, it's like different elements of magical armor to defeat the Moon King. And in Coco, it's he's looking for, he has to like enter a competition to try and win, to get into a party, to meet a guy who's going to give him a blessing to send him back to where he's come from. Without getting too spoilery about it.
No, they're very good movies.
Yeah. I think they're both really, really fantastic movies. I'd recommend either to anyone.
Yeah. And it's for people who both like the different types of art style, obviously there are quite heavy subjects involved.
Yeah.
But it's enough to like both entertain parents and children of all ages. It's very difficult to continue on talking about this without like spoiling anything.
Yeah.
Because there are so many comparisons between these two movies, it's actually shocking.
Yeah.
Well, it's like I said earlier, you just like write the same script, the same plot, and then just set it in two different places.
But without either of them feeling like a ripoff way.
Yeah, it's quite shocking. I don't know.
I guess there's only so many ways to explain death to children.
Yeah.
To say like, hey, here's what happens, here's why we talk about our loved ones, here's why we think about them when they pass on, even though it's, you know, it can be difficult to do so, you know, you got to keep people's stories going.
It's also very different in different cultures as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's obviously the way this has come through in the storytelling, because they are about different cultures and the way they deal with, you know, memory and family. I don't feel like the way it's treated from European descendant people in New Zealand as well as it's done with Tangata Whenua and the way the iwis deal with it. I know the Irish have a very different way of dealing with it, but then it might be, I don't know what the difference between how Catholics and Protestants really deal with the whole situation, because I haven't gone to either funerals, but I've remembered what you said, which is very similar to some places I've been to in New Zealand when I've gone to tangis, which is like the body is there in the house.
Yeah.
And you're just like sitting around making small talk with people and drinking tea and eating biscuits.
Yeah, I think I always find it interesting in like American media when there's like open caskets at a church or at a service, because that's not really how it's done in Ireland. When it's gone to the church, it's sealed.
Yeah.
But it's quite common for the person's body in a coffin with no lid on it to be just in their family home for several days beforehand, like. Maybe it moves there on a Thursday and the funeral's until the Monday or Tuesday. And there'll be, like, you know, a particular... It kind of depends, because sometimes it is, like, just a one-day thing. And people will come and there'll be, like, a designated, here's the time to come over and pay respects. But other times it'll be this whole weekend. Come by over this weekend. And the thing that I find very different between how Māori people, like Tangata Whenua, as you said... deal with death is that it's very much they have this concept of like tapu, which is like a sacredness, and when you're around the deceased person you're in that state of tapu, and then you have to bring yourself back to Noah or like kind of a normalcy before you can do other things, whereas in Ireland it's like you're sitting there with your cup of tea next to the body, chatting to the wife of the deceased. You know, it's definitely there's a different kind of level of casualness there. And I think that's partly just like the age of these cultures.
Yeah.
I feel like, I mean, it's, I, you know, I'm not I think both are valid things to be doing in valid ways to, like, show your respects or whatever. But I think that in Ireland, we've just been around death for a very long time. You know, we've suffered through famines and occupations and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, over literally thousands of years, to the point that we're just like, yep.
So casual about this. Kind of weird.
Weird to other cultures, maybe.
From a
very normal.
Yeah, it's... I can understand why in... From the process of a tangi, why they do have these two steps when you are sort of, you know, everything is sacred and then you can go back to normality. Yeah.
I fully get it.
Yeah, like I can understand it from a scientific point of view of like, cool, don't eat around a dead body, guys.
Yeah, true.
Like, wash your hands.
The other thing is that, like, you know, nowadays that's more of a sterile environment than it would have been.
Yeah, it's... It's interesting.
Because the body will, you know, at least in our children, will have gone to a funeral home and prepared first before it goes and sits in a house. And then you have what's called a removal, which is the removal to the church.
Mm.
So it's when it leaves the home, or sometimes a funeral home if they don't have a display in a home, and goes to the church. And then that's normally the night before the funeral, so that the body stays there overnight. And then what's quite common... more common in countryside in Ireland, I feel like, than in, like, cities, is that there will be, like, a full funeral procession then, where everyone will go from the church with the coffin to where it's being buried.
Fun fact, if you're in a convoy for a funeral in New Zealand, in the road code, you have to drive with your headlights on dim.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. It's one of those things that comes up in the questionnaire.
I have definitely been to funerals in Ireland where the funeral procession was on foot.
Okay.
like I said, more so in the countryside than in the city. But yeah, there will be convoys through the city where everyone's following in cars. You let the hearse go first and then follow. But I don't feel like we have anything in Irish culture that's... I mean, obviously we do have similar to Dia de los Muertos, which is... because we have the Samhain, which is Halloween, and then we have... But that's, you know, it's kind of more connected to less the spirit world and more like the Fae.
Yeah.
But then we have...
just remember, kids, don't eat their food and don't give them your name.
Yes. I was going to say, unless you're trans and you want to give away your dead name, then they've taken it from you. What was I going to say? We have All Souls Day, which is either the same day or like a day after Dia de los Muertos. I think they're very close in time. But we don't do that whole... We don't obviously do the ofrenda thing or anything similar, and we don't have this belief that people are coming back to us or that we can lead them back or whatever. But I do think there is a strong storytelling culture.
Yeah.
And, you know... Both, I think that's in a lot of places.
Very beautiful in their own way. I kind of want to keep this episode short. Because, like I said, I feel like we've jumped into things that, you know, will spoil the story. even if, as careful as we could be. Is there any other trivia you want to go into?
Yeah, there's definitely some trivia. Not like a crazy amount, but... I feel like most of what I took down about Kubo and the Two Strings was just, like, related to stop-motion animation. That's crazy. So at the time it was released, it was the longest stop-motion feature film to date, at 1 hour and 41 minutes long, but it has since been overtaken by Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, which came out in 2022. There's a skeleton demon in it, which we haven't mentioned yet, but there is a scene with a skeleton demon, which is based on, this is something from Japanese folklore that I am going to try my best to pronounce, which is the Gashodokuro, and it's that demon is the largest stop-motion puppet to ever be built. It's 18 feet tall.
Yeah, it's...
And I believe it weighs 82 kilograms, I think. I didn't take that down, but I remember reading that. That's very large.
Yeah. There is a at the end of the movie, there's like a reveal of said thing.
Yeah,
and it is massive.
In the credits at the end of the movie, they show them rigging up this puppet, and it's very, very large. Also, there's a sequence where they're traveling by boat, and it's Kubo has used his his origami magic powers to create a boat out of fallen leaves, which is beautiful and very cool. And the sequence that the sequence of film on the boat took 19 months to shoot.
Wow.
So that's not even counting like the time put into like hand creating all these little leaves, which they did, but just to actually film it, it took 19 months. Kubo had 23,187 prototype faces.
Wow.
Which were used, he could have 48 million possible facial expressions.
That's ridiculous.
For the sequence, I don't want to give away this.
Then don't.
But I'll talk about it without talking about what the sequence is or what it's about. But there is, because we've mentioned this skeleton, there is another sequence with another monster that has, like, they wanted it to have, like, a bioluminescent glow.
Yeah.
And how they did that was they created all of its parts individually, separately, made them all partially translucent, put a reflective golden material stuck to the inside, and they used mylar, which is a material found in party balloons.
Yep.
And then they had to get pretty much, I think I said they were in Seattle, Washington, but Portland, Oregon is actually where Leica are based. I went too far north.
Yep.
They had to buy out the stock at every party balloon shop Portland to make it. It works though, like this thing glows on screen. And it's a practical effect, which I love. And then the other thing I talked about Kubo was, so the stop motion animation in it was inspired by Japanese media, such as ink wash painting, ukiyo-e, is that how that's pronounced? Ukiyo-e woodblock printing, and origami, obviously. And they got assistance from a 3D printing firm called Stratasys, who let them use their latest technology in exchange for giving them feedback on it. So they basically use this movie to quality assurance test.
It's a 3D
printing. A new 3D printing technology.
That's great.
Which I think is great. For Coco, I find it really hard to get good trivia for Disney and Pixar films because any trivia section on any website is just full of people saying, this is how many hidden Mickey Mouse heads are in this movie. This is where you can see Buzz and Woody from Toy Story as pinatas, So I've cut it down quite short. I've said Miguel, apparently the character Miguel was only supposed to play guitar. He was never supposed to sing in the movie, in the original draft of the movie. But the actor who plays him, Anthony Gonzalez, is actually a talented singer, and when Leon Crick, the director, discovered that, he rewrote it so that Anthony could share his singing talent in the movie. How the Land of the Dead looks in the movie is inspired by the Mexican city of Guanajuato, which has got all these colorful houses on the hillside in the way that they look like they're almost stacked on top of each other. Mm. This movie was in active production between 2011 and 2017, and it set the record for being the Pixar animated film with the longest production schedule. There is a bit... So this is when Miguel basically gets into his situation. Mm. He turns ghostly so that people around him can't see him anymore. And when he does that after he strums the guitar and he runs into the graveyard in a panic, the musical score that plays him behind him is the crescendo from A Day in the Life by the Beatles.
Oh, wow.
Which I mention, I put this in here mainly because the end credits of Kubo and the Two Strings is a cover of While My Guitar Gently Weeps by the Beatles. And I thought that was nice that they both use Beatles music. And then, I mentioned already that alebrijes were figurines made out of papier-mâché or carved out of wood, representing mythical animal hybrids. essentially the Pixar team came across these while they were doing research for the film, and they just really loved the look of them and then adapted them into these guidance spirit animals in the Land of the Dead. And I will just touch on budget and box office very quickly. Have you looked at these at all?
In glancing, but I don't think I remember.
Right, so Kubo was essentially a flop, which is very sad.
Yeah.
It cost $60 million to make, and it only made $76 million at box office. Which is such a shame, because it is a stunning film. It's so beautiful. It's so well written and well told, and like really well acted as well. And it's such a shame that it didn't make more than that.
Yeah.
And then Coco, the budget was $175 million. And being a very popular Pixar film, it made $815 million at box office.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah. Definitely one more successful than the other. I think Coco was the higher rated of the two as well, but I don't think there was that much of a difference in the rating.
Mm.
I would say these are kind of on par with each other quality-wise.
Yeah, 100%. It would be very difficult to... You'd have to get, like, repeatedly sit there and watch both at the same time and be like, well, this is different from this one, and therefore that one's better than the other. They are both very enjoyable movies for adults, for kids. It's very difficult to narrow down anything that would distinguish them apart, other than the animation style and the culture.
Even that, like, there's such beautiful artistry in both films, and like even down to the costume design, where they both have, you know, they've obviously had costume designers for doing like kind of traditional costumes for these cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Both films, obviously making that digitally for Coco, but physically making the costumes for Kubo. That must be fun to be a costume designer for stop motion animation, because you get to make these little costumes.
I think it would be terrifying and very, very difficult. Because you're not like making a full shirt, you're making like a shirt that can come off in like different directions if they need to move things.
I found it really interesting, because I had a moment watching Kubo where, so he has, there's these two creepy, basically kind of witch ladies who are supposed to be his aunts. In Kubo, you're looking at me like you don't remember.
I'm just looking at you like, stop spoilering.
That's not a spoiler, I don't think. But they wear these masks, and I had a moment where I was like, oh, they're just trying to, you know, make it easier on themselves so they don't have to show facial expressions on these stop motion characters. But then you look at them, and like every, like their fabric on their clothes is flowing, their hair is moving, and you're like, okay, no, they're still like, it's not like that. It's not like, you know, cheap Japanese TV animation where they just don't change the still. They just like have a monologue over a still image, so that they didn't have
Speed Racer alone, right?
But you know what I mean. Like that's so common, I think you would notice it if they just stood there and did nothing. It's a technique in like hand drawn animation called boiling. If you do like a single level animation, which is where instead of being on different cells, everything is drawn on the one sheet of paper. Yeah. So if it means that, like, no matter how uniform you try to make it, there will be slight changes from page to page. So if you suddenly stop animating it, it's really obvious.
Yeah.
So what you do is you have, like, maybe five versions of it that you kind of rotate over and over again, and it's called boiling.
Mm.
So I wonder, did they do a little bit of that with them? But maybe. I didn't watch closely enough to see if the you know, the cloaks flowing or whatever did it in the same pattern over and over. I think with this film, it's high enough quality that you would notice if that was happening, though. So I reckon that's, they've gone through and individually done it for the whole duration,
which is madness.
Yeah, well, it's just, I just think there's such an art. I mean, I think there's definitely obviously a lot of work that goes into CG animation as well, but there's just like something like
tangible.
It's physically. Yeah. There's just something so wonderfully artistic about stop motion animation, and especially like when you put the level of detail and craftsmanship into it that Leica do.
Yeah.
Because everything they do is like this.
Yeah.
And I feel like Kubo is probably my favorite of the films, which is controversial because I know people love Coraline.
Yeah.
And Coraline is fantastic. But I think Kubo and the Two Strings is just on a different level for me, personally.
That's fair. If you've enjoyed this podcast, make sure to share it with somebody else. And you can join us on our website, ittakes2.co.nz, where you'll find a list to all of our social media, including Blue Sky and Discord. And we will hope to catch you next time on the next episode. Or just, you know, you fast-forwarded through this part and now you're already listening to the next episode. Who knows? Thank you for joining us.
We'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.